I am Peddlin' Ron, and you're listening to Bicycle Talk. It's November 7th, 2017. Welcome to Bicycle Talk, this week with my co-host, the lovely Fran Storch.
Hi.
A show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show, you can call or text us right now at 860-486-9487, or you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com, or you can simply visit Bicycle Talk on Facebook. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org or on iTunes. If you'd like to contribute or to be on the show as a guest, please contact me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. Okay, moving forward to Ron's rant of the week. Okay, here's a weird one. I found this and I was completely taken back by this. Cyclist gets sued by motorist. Yeah. It was entitled, "This Can't Be Happening." The cyclist was Nako Nakatsuka, and she was struck from behind, and the driver sued her. Okay? So, a little story here. For the first time in her life, Nako had felt hopeless. On April 6th, 2014, a typical upbeat biochemistry grad student and a member of the UCLA triathlon team had been making a left turn off of Santa Monica Boulevard on a road bike when a car drifted into the turn lane and hit her from behind. But it wasn't the crash that got to her. It was what came in the mail a month later, an insurance bill for damage to the vehicle that had hit her, along with the threat of a lawsuit. So, things started off normal enough post-crash, according to Nakatsuka, then 23. The driver got out of his car, apologized profusely, and even fetched water for her as she lay dazed in the middle of the busy road. Because she feared additional legal action from the driver, we've agreed to withhold the motorist's name. So we're going to cruise on by that. But anyway, when she contacted the driver's insurance company about her medical bills, she suffered a concussion, severe bruising, permanent damage to her glutes. She discovered that the LAPD had never filed a report, despite issuing her a receipt for one. The driver had also told her insurance company that she had caused the crash by backing her bike into the vehicle. Hello. Oh, come on. So, she quotes, "I think they thought I was a motorcycle. I was on a motorcycle," she says. It was like, number one, I was on a bicycle. How could I even do that? So the LAPD wouldn't put her in touch with the cops who had been on the scene. When she contacted the branch responsible for the traffic collisions in the area, she was told the LAPD almost never files crash reports for incidents involving bicycles. Shame on you, LAPD. Part of the rant. The LAPD disputes this. A media relations rep said that anytime someone reports a crash involving injuries, officers always take a report, give it a number, and file it. Although the division wasn't able to determine that four cop cars and an ambulance had been at the intersection of the time of the crash, there wasn't really much that Nakatsuka could do but file a belated report. In the meantime, notices from the driver's insurance company kept coming in, and the damages increased until they topped out at $4,000. So they're suing her for hitting, for them, for their vehicle of their driver hitting her, even though they claim it's the other way around because there wasn't a proper report filed. So we're going to talk about this in just a second. But anyway, her lawyer said, no matter how hard you fight this, you're going to pay for it more than she does, even if we go to court, even if we win. Her insurance will pay for her stuff, but not for everything that will come out of your pocket. It's a lose-lose situation. The friends convinced her to go start a GoFundMe campaign, which prompted an outpouring of support, which was very nice. Because the deal was that when she got a hold of a lawyer to reach a settlement from the insurance company dropped the lawsuit and they paid her $2,000, which didn't come close to covering the $10,000 that she owed the hospital in legal fees. So anyway, just crazy stuff. So here's the thing that we can learn from this. If you get involved in an accident with a motorized vehicle on your bicycle, call the police. If once they come, you need to be very, very diligent about making sure that you follow through, make sure the report is filed, make sure you have a copy of that report. If there are any witnesses that are there at the time of the accident, please beg for their names, their contact information, anything you can, because this is crazy. This is just total craziness. So yeah,
there was,
what do you got?
So yeah, I'm not sure if you saw this, but Nako Nakatsuka created a website called bikewoke.com.
Oh, I missed that part.
Yes. And so this bikewoke.com, after she did that GoFundMe, all kinds of cyclists reached out to her who had been in similar circumstances.
Excellent.
And so she put together a crash database called bikewoke.com. And it helps cyclists to know their rights in the event of a crash, gather evidence at the scene, connect with each other, and contact bike-friendly lawyers.
Look at that. Well, you know, she deserves a on the positive side for that. But
yes,
we'll save it for another week. That's
yes,
that's really cool.
Yeah.
I see it here now. That's really nice.
Yes.
Very cool. So something very good became of it. That's a good thing. That's a very good thing.
But it's horrifying. What was that driver thinking?
What was the driver thinking, A? B, who lied and said that she ran into the car
she
driver?
She backed up and ran and...
That she, on the bicycle, backed into the car, therefore now the car is going to sue the bike? Who came up with that story? Was it the LAPD? Or was it the driver of the car who was flat out lying because she didn't want to have any kind of a claim on her insurance?
Or perhaps the driver found out that, hey, they don't usually file reports for car versus bicycle. I'll try to sue her. And it turned out I can only win. She may not have good insurance to cover me, and she
right,
may have to take a settlement. And
right,
and because it did turn out it went against this young woman.
Right. Right, which is crazy. The other thing is...
There's a special place in hell for that driver. Shame on her.
Boy, don't get Fran angry.
No, you're right. Would you do that? Why would you do something so crass and so horrible? Why not? I mean, if I hit a cyclist... I actually hit a young woman with my car
that
once.
Knocked the mirror off your car. I remember that.
Maybe.
I remember it was a Mitsubishi.
I was driving somewhere and a bunch of kids ran across the street.
Right.
They were in dark clothes and they ran into my car. And I couldn't stop fast enough. And I nicked one of the young girls and I went to talk to them. And I pulled over. I was on my way out of town
and
for the weekend. And I'm like, well, I guess I'm not going. And I pulled over and I ran to her to see if she was okay, if she wanted anything, if I could call an ambulance, if she wanted me to take her to the ER. They didn't want anything. They didn't want me to do anything. And I stayed there with her just to make sure until they left me. She and her
right,
two friends walked away from me. There was
right,
nothing I could do. I didn't know her name. I didn't know anything. I mean, she didn't want me to call the police, so I didn't.
There could be a number of reasons for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. They may have been doing something they shouldn't have been doing, in which case that's why they walked out into the street without
yes,
warning. I mean, they could have been doing something that would have gotten them in trouble if the authorities had showed up.
Right.
So, you know.
That's probably what happened.
Which is fine, but at the same time.
But I felt so bad. I stopped my car and I wanted to take responsibility for it, whatever it was. And I don't understand the thought process of this crass individual for not taking responsibility for what she had done. And she was nice at the scene.
Yeah.
And then she turned on her.
Right. Exactly.
Somebody gave her some advice that, hey, if you sue her, you could get some money out of this.
Right.
But it's because, you know, the law tends to favor cars over cyclists.
Tends to?
Yes. And so that's why this driver got away with it. But shame on her. Just because how... Even if you're going to get a lot of money out of it, how could you do something that's so unconscionable? Don't you care about the quality of your soul?
I do. You do. You know, that's obvious. But, you know, I think that there are more people in the world that don't than do sometimes.
Ugh.
No, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to actually say I think there's more good people than there are bad people. But there would be even more good people if they all just rode a bike.
Yeah.
As I always am stating. So anyway, that's my rant of the week. Cars suing bicycles. That's pretty, that's really pushing it over the edge. That's for sure. So moving on from that one right there, we're going to go to on a positive side. And on a positive side, and they have been mentioned before, they were mentioned last week. They keep getting lots of credits here. And on a positive side is bikewalkct.org, Bike Walk Connecticut. I attended last Friday evening an annual dinner, and they had a silent auction there too in Hartford for Bike Walk Connecticut. And there were a number of people that were recipients of People's Choice Awards, which is really nice. And some of them have been on our show. Tony Sorellis from Hartford, definitely he got one. Very, very nice. He and Joseph both. They both got an award, which is really nice. Sylvia, our friend from Bolton, Connecticut, she received an award, which is really cool. And I was trying to get a whole list of these before the show, but it didn't come through. So if I get them for next week, I will definitely mention them. Because there were numbers of people that are doing really cool things for cycling, and they're organizing a lot of things. There's a couple out of West Hartford.
One of them was you.
And yes, I was going to get there. But much to my surprise, and you know, it's great. I was one of them. So your good friend here at Bicycle Talk, Pedlin Ron, received an award for, you know, outstanding service to his community and recognition for it. And I thank the people, because there were a number of people that I found out later had submitted my name. But first of all, the other Tony from Hartford definitely was one of the first ones to. He's a big fan. Thanks, Tony. Anyway, very, very nice. Really appreciated it. It was a very, very nice thing. So big shout out to ConnecticutBikeWalk.org, because they're just great. Great organization. Do a lot of really cool things. Lots of great people there. Really fun. Oh, you know who else was on there? Also a guest from the show were the folks from CCAP. They also got an award. So lots of people that have been on the Bicycle Talk show were recipients of People's Choice Awards. So that's kind of a neat thing. And more power to them. Keep doing what you do. And it's just a really, really good thing. Next on my list, I am bringing on the weekly Maintenance Minute. And I thought this week I would try something just a little bit different here, and I wanted to address a couple of things that people get a little confused about. Now, I'm going to tell you that I'm going to give you some advice here on the show, but if you really want to get your bike done right, find a good bicycle shop, because these guys do it for a living. They've seen everything. They know a lot, and if any of this confuses you, and you're not, or if you're not mechanical in any way, or if you think you're mechanical, but every time you touch something, it just doesn't seem to work out that way, go visit your local bike shop. That would be my words of strong encouragement there. But we're going to talk about front and rear derailleurs on multi-speed bicycles. And they can be a little, what can I say here? Well, they can be a little confusing, because they, as simple as they are, there are a couple little tricks that you have to know and you have to pay attention to when adjusting them. I went to a great place to learn more about this, and I will direct my listeners to this too. Go to www.parktool.com. The Park Tool Company is a bicycle tool company which has been making bicycle tools for the bicycle industry, especially the professional bicycle industry, for many, many years. And then they also make consumer tools too. And it's as it is a minor promotion for them, they have some really cool things on their website. And the cool things they have on their website is how to do things. And here I have front derailleur adjustment. So they have an article about it. It talks about the basic things that you need as far as tools go. Obviously, you'll need a screwdriver for turning adjustment screws. You might need an Allen wrench, or depending on what the age is of the bike, you might need an 8 or 10 or 9 millimeter wrench too, to secure down fixing bolts and all on the bike. But anyway, they give kind of a really nice detailed explanation about how you set up your front derailleur on your bike and the things to look for. So before you start checking for screw limitations and screw adjustments on the bike, check out the derailleur position. This is a great suggestion, because if you don't get the position of the derailleur correctly lined up, you're going to be fighting the whole way, and all you're going to end up with is just a pile of frustration. So the two things you want to look at is, you want to look at the height alignment of the front derailleur, and the outer cage plate should be positioned over the largest chain ring when in viewing height, and you simply grab the exposed front derailleur inner wire until the outer cage is directly over the outer chain ring, and you use care not to shift the derailleur past this point. So you know, you're going to note your height and your direction as far as that goes just by taking a look at it. You also want to look at the gap between the teeth on the outer chainring and the lower edge of the outer cage plate should be no more than 1 to 2 millimeters, about the thickness of a penny. So if you don't have anything to measure that with, grab a penny, stick it in there. If the penny just fits or fits very snugly, then you're close enough, which is really cool. So it says here, using a penny or a dime as a feeler gauge will fit it between the chainring teeth and the cage plate. It should fit just between the teeth and the plate. So that's where you get your height. And then you want to look at the rotational angle of the front derailleur. The rotational angle is going to be the way that you see the chain gliding through the cage. So you're going to look at it from the top looking down. And it really needs to be, what you do is you shift your chain up into the outermost chain ring and the outermost rear sprocket. So in the largest gear on the bike, basically. And then sight the chain from directly above the chain rings, consider the chain as representing a straight line. Compare this to the outer derailleur cage plate, and they should be parallel. So that's pretty simple. If there's a little bit of an angle there, it's going to cause a problem. You're going to get rubbing. It's not going to work well. Again, this takes a little bit of practice. It takes a little bit of playing around with it. In the Northeast here, as it starts getting cold and you're stuck inside a little bit more than you are outside, maybe you're not riding your bike outdoors as much, or maybe you're spending more time in the gym because you're trying to keep your fitness up, it's a great time to work on your bike and learn more about your bike too. And we'll probably explore this even more in the future. So there's also tips here about your limit screw adjustments and settings. There's also tips here about your cable tension and where it should be and how it should be. There's a lot of fine measuring of tolerances when you're doing front derailleur adjustment. They can be frustrating. I even though I've worked on them my whole life, I can say that front derailleurs can sometimes be frustrating. And you want to keep it from rubbing, but as, of course, we have increased in our number of gears in the back of the bike, we tend to get more problems with rubbing. Now, you want to eliminate all that. You want to make it so it's super silent. Go electronic. You go with a electronic shifting drivetrain, and you won't have as many problems anymore, because the front derailleur automatically trims and adjusts with the rear derailleur, and so you eliminate a lot of that. But if you don't have that luxury or that option, you have to very carefully adjust things. So there's a lot of things that you can pay attention to here. The website is great. Again, it's Park Tool. And they also have a piece on rear derailleur adjustment. And the rear derailleur adjustment is not as tricky as you would think. But I always start out with, and if you are going to be adjusting your rear derailleur and you're going to be picky about how it runs and how it operates all the time, and you ride on a bicycle that has a breakaway hanger or a removable hanger on it, which most aluminum bicycles and most carbon, well, pretty much all the carbon bikes, I haven't seen any of them yet, that don't have a removable hanger, because if you bend that hanger, you ruin the frame. So there's a removable piece in the back that you can swap out when it gets damaged, so that you can not lose your frame in the process. So I own, and I think everyone should own one of these. I own a hanger adjustment tool. There's an actual tool. It is made by a number of different manufacturers. The one I have at home is a Park. My favorite one that I used to have was a Campy, and unfortunately, I sold my Campy tool with my bike shop. Shouldn't have done that. Anyway, because the Campy one just... it just feels right. I can't explain it. I was talking to a dealer about that 2 weeks ago at a bike shop, and I went, oh, you have a Campy adjustment tool. And I noticed he had a Park one hanging up on his tool bench, too. And I said, but you have a Park one, too. And he goes, I like the Campy one. He goes, it just feels right. And so, and those of you who are out there who are totally geeky like I am, you know the difference between a Campy tool and other tools. They really are very, very nice. So anyway, the first thing I always do before I get into adjustments of my rear derailleur is I put a hanger tool on, because the hanger tool will show you if the hanger is aligned correctly, and then you start from that point and then work your way out from there. That's my particular advice on that. I find that with a lot of the new bikes, some of the hangers that come through are a little on the soft side, and they do tend to get bent very easily. Like if you're wheeling your bike outside and you accidentally tap it against the door frame on your way out, you can actually bend the hanger. They're soft. They don't really stand up well, but they're designed that way, but they're also, you know, they're very delicate. So I'm a big believer of the hanger tool. I'm also a really big believer of going to wheels manufacturing and getting a hanger which doesn't bend as easily. There are also aluminum hangers. There are also breakaway hangers, but they do tend to be a higher quality material. They're machined really well, and they're available for almost all bicycles that are out there. So that's another suggestion that I would have. From that point, it's the same thing as with the front derailleur. It's an alignment issue. It's looking at the alignment, getting in the back of the bike and sighting it down and seeing where things fall and where they land. I start out initially by releasing all of the tension on the cable and letting the derailleur just naturally fall down into the highest gear on the bike and make sure the alignment is correct there. From that point, then I start with tightening the cable back up and making adjustments from that point. So anyway, they have lots of information here. There's more than I can possibly share with you here on the site, but I would strongly urge that you go to the Park Tool site. So it's www.parktool.com, and they can give you an awful lot of information there. So those would be my maintenance minute tips for this week, derailleur adjustment. So I put out a number of things on the Bicycle Talk Facebook page, and I'm getting lots of responses from you guys and girls out there, and I am thrilled. I am absolutely thrilled with some of the cool responses that are out. I ended up taking one of my episodes, which I had done a number of weeks ago. It was episode 70, if you're following me on whus.org or on iTunes. And we had talked about, I had a segment of it where I put some detail into talking about bicycle shop etiquette. And I got some requests from the bicycle shops, and they said, you know, Ron, hey, we love your show. We love that thing you did about the etiquette. That was really great. Is there any way you can drop it down to just that piece right there and set it up for us so we can use it on our websites? By the way, if you want to use any of this on your websites or on your Facebook pages, I strongly encourage you to go there, because I do have a number of dealers that are doing that now, and I personally get a lot of hits from it, which is kind of nice. I always like to see that, and my bike shops are really starting to enjoy some of the advice that we give here at Bicycle Talk. So I had put this together in a shorter version, and it does talk about the struggling bicycle shops and the difficulties that they have, and why a customer should try to work on a relationship with their local bike shop, and why the local bike shop should work on their relationships with their customers. So I hit from both ends on this, but I got a comment, and the comment came from my friend Justin, who's out in the great Northwest, And he's a big-time bike rider. He used to ride here all the time before he moved out. He's now, I think, pretty big in the mountain bike scene more than anything else. But he made a comment back to me, and he said, Ron, if the local bike shop is struggling, why should the customer have to follow etiquette? Why not go online and get whatever I want cheaper and not have to kiss the ring? Isn't it time for the local bike shop to ask itself, what can I offer the customer to make his or her experience better? And he sent me a link. And the link was about the modern bike shop and where the modern bike shop is going. So this particular article that came out about it was talking about a bike shop that had moved on to opening a cafe in their store. So they put a cafe in, so they're selling coffee and they're making it comfortable for people to hang around and just enjoy the atmosphere of the bike shop and all. And it was a very nice piece. And I thanked him for sharing it. And I told him I would bring it up on the next show, because I know a number of bike shops that have had to diversify in order to keep up with the pack. Little bicycle quote there. Unfortunately, it's very unfortunate that a bike shop has to be a cafe, but survival has become more creative these days. And I mentioned to him that when I had my store, shipping items from my town was difficult, so I opened a UPS customer counter in my shop, and it paid for the lights and the heat. I'll admit it, it worked. I diversified a little bit, and it also brought in a number of new faces into the store. So I get it. I understand it. I just find it's a shame that bike shops have to go in this direction in order to stay alive. Why can't they just be bike shops, and why can't the cafes just be cafes? I get a little frustrated with this. But again, you know, it's a new world. Things are different. People are buying online. People are really cutting into a lot of the profit centers that the stores used to have that did keep them alive and kicking, and they're eating away at the areas that helped pay for the lights, pay for the heat, pay for the employees, and it's tough. But it's a sign of the times. It's what we have. So I'm going to move to the next item on my list here, and in which also talks more about the road booty story. The road booty story has been good. Everybody adds a little more road booty in every week. So I have Tim here who, outside of a few tools and a returned cell phone, found somebody's cell phone and returned it to him. He also found $20 on the road. So I guess I was paid for that day of bike to work. So that was kind of a neat thing. I have another one here from Bob Davis. He found a $20 bill, and he's very excited by that. Another one here, good old Tony Trillis. Tony says, does a regular stop by way of the bike at trailside town to transfer station count? So, well, I guess so. He said, not his best find by far, but he always appreciates an unopened roadside beer. Okay, I haven't gotten that one yet. So there you go, Tony. You got it. You got a hot one there. He says he finds one or two of those per year. So people throw full beers out of their cars, hopefully not at the cyclist. I had that happen once. It missed me by inches, but I could hear the whirring of the wind as the beer can went flying by my head. And it was truly a full beer when it went through. Dumb idea. Someone could have really hurt me. But people don't think when they do things like that. So anyway, apparently Tony finds beer, and he's not shy on picking them up and bringing them home and having a nice frosty beer after he gets back with his find. He also says, he's got a few of these, he also stops at free curb piles on the regular basis. So you know how some people put stuff out on the curb and they put free on it, and it's just a pile of stuff they're trying to get rid of, and they figure maybe they can recycle it onto somebody who needs. Well, he says he always has a rack, bungee cords, and usually panniers to bring home good stuff. So that's another piece that we found. And then I have another entry here from Peter Koskinen, and he found a wad of $20 bills totaling $360 once in Washington, D.C. Crazy. This one makes me smile because very, very clever. Bob Watson said spark plugs, and then there's a comma and it says, think about that one. Okay. So if you're riding down the road and you see a spark plug on the side of the road, where did it come from? If it fell out of someone's engine, that's not a good thing. That would not be a good thing at all. So, and how does a spark plug fall out of one's engine? And so anyway, Bob, I did think about that. That's a good one. Thank you very much for your entry. I do appreciate that. Gary Duckett found a perfect pair of high-end sunglasses. And John Andrews said, not falling off with a question mark. I'm not quite sure how to respond to that. So anyway, I do appreciate your responding to the bike booty question. The bike booty question is still open. If you want to address it, you can address it by contacting me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com, or you can go to my Facebook page, which is where a lot of people are going with this, and you can find me at Bicycle Talk on Facebook and let me hear about your favorite road booty. This is fun. It's kind of entertaining. I got another request recently, actually this morning, from my friend Billy, who said that he was having this discussion with a friend about road bike brakes, disc brakes in particular on road bikes versus caliper brakes on road bikes. So the question is, well, his question was a weight-related question because he was having a discussion with someone, and he wanted to see if he could get an answer here. I think he's trying to win a bet, but Billy, if you win the bet, you gotta split the beer with me, okay? We gotta do something about that. But anyway, we'll talk about that one later. So there's a lot of debate still out there about the disc brake situation. I'll get to Billy's, which are lighter, later. I'll get to that later. But there's just a ton of discussion about this, you know, do I need disc brakes, road bike, caliper brakes versus disc brakes. And Bicycling Magazine and Velo News have both had articles about the banning of disc brakes by the cycling's governing body because they found that they might be dangerous in some way. So there's that going on. I'm not sure if that's been resolved yet. I still don't think there are disc brakes on the Pro Peloton. I don't think they're out there yet because they had some issues with them. They can be very sharp and they can be very hot when you end up in a pileup. And if you're in a professional bike race, you're probably going to end up in a pileup occasionally. So that can be a problem. So anyway, it's just the debate is out there. It's still out there. I don't know what more to say about it, but I am in particular one of those old curmudgeons, and I will probably always be one of those old curmudgeons because I'm not getting any younger, and I just like my caliper brakes on my bike. If you put a really high-quality set of caliper brakes or even a medium-quality set of caliper brakes on your bike, nice side-pull brakes, they work great. They really work well. And even, you know, on a cross bike, which I know they're probably more preferred on a cross bike than they are on a road bike, even so, because of the situation that you run into with dampness and, you know, wet situations where your brakes just don't work that well. I still like the feel of the caliper. I just feel like I have more control of my bike. But even though all the surveys show that the disc brakes definitely stop you faster, and they are certainly more efficient in wet weather. There's no question about that. But I still just like the feel of a regular caliper brake. And again, if it's a good quality brake. Now, I have ridden on some brakes that are of questionable quality or questionable brand. And I would say this is a shout out to those companies that may make a very popular bicycle, and they may equip it with the latest and greatest from Campy or Shimano or SRAM, but then they go to the brakes and they put their own brand, we'll call it, brake onto the bike. So it has their name on it, and it, you know, looks like a good brake, but they just don't work that good. So because they're using an inferior quality brake, which they brand themselves to make it look like they've got something nice on the bike, but You know, if you're gonna, I'll shout out to Shimano on this one. If you're gonna use a good quality Shimano road group, or even a lower quality one, stick with the brakes. Don't play around with it. Stick with their brakes. They work really well, and they're certainly way better than the generic knockoffs that will maybe keep the price of the bike down a little bit, but they're certainly not going to be able to stop you with the same efficiency or quality that you would get from the real deal. So again, I'm more of a caliper brake kind of guy, but I see more and more of these bikes coming out with discs on them. I talk to the people that have the discs, and they seem super psyched about them. They really like them. They like the way they feel. They're very, I guess they're cleaner looking because of the fact that you don't have, I'm going to debate that too. I don't think they're cleaner looking. I think they look silly on a bicycle, but that's me. And I understand other opinions, and please voice your concerns. I love a good discussion. So, if you're riding on carbon wheels, yeah, disc brakes are probably a whole lot better, because there's not many brake pads that work really well against those carbon wheels. And you're also going to deal with an element of wear on the rim. Now, with a regular caliper brake, you're also going to deal with a level of wear on the rim too. But the question is, if you use your brakes that much over that many years, shouldn't you be replacing that rim eventually anyway? Just ponder that moment there. And if you take a look at the size and the diameter of a wheel, it's a very, very, very large disc. So it essentially is the same thing. Yeah, I know. Doesn't work as well in the rain. Got that. And yes, I do agree. If you're on a tandem, the disc brakes are probably a big advantage, because you've got a lot of weight on the tandem and they really do make a big difference. And also, if you're on a touring bike and you're fully loaded, let's say you have, 30 to 40 pounds of weight on your bicycle, it's nice to have the extra braking power. So I think they have a place, but they don't have a place on any of my bikes. Not yet. I'm not ready for that yet. But so that's my disc brake story. That's how I feel about it. I find them also, especially, and we'll go back to that same thing I talked about earlier with the rim brakes or the caliper brakes. There's a quality issue here too. So, buy up. Don't put an inexpensive disc on your bike, or try to avoid a bike that comes with an inexpensive disc on it. If they're just trying to sell you the bicycle with the disc brake on it for the idea that discs are so much better and it's a really cheap disc, you're not going to be happy. You're really not. So you want to get something that's reasonable quality, because otherwise you're going to have a lot of problems. The other thing that we have found out in the cyclocross world, especially when the weather gets to be very bad during a race. So let's say classic Northeast, November, December, maybe January Nationals here in Hartford, which we had. And you get snow and ice and mud and all sorts of crud, the pads wear out super quick on disc brakes, really, really quickly. So if you're running a carbon wheel, of course, you'll prefer to have the disc brake. But if you're running an aluminum wheel, you'll get a couple of seasons out of that wheel without any trouble at all with the caliper brake. And they tend to be less problematic when the weather gets bad, in as far as longevity goes. But I saw a couple of years ago, actually, I had a friend of mine who was working in I think it was in Kentucky, where they had the Nationals, and they had just some ugly, ugly weather, lots of mud and lots of cold, and so their things were freezing, and it was really bad. And he said that the pro bike mechanics were pumping through, they do maybe a lap on the bike, and they would drop their bikes off because the riders would look at them and say, the brakes, fix the brakes. And they look at the brakes and the pads were worn out in one lap in a big race like that. Now, it's an unusual situation, but they do wear out a lot quicker. That's just been my observation. It's been the observation of a number of folks that I know that work on the pro race circuit. So it's great if you have the money to do that, but it's also a lot of work. It's a lot of maintenance. And if you don't get those discs right, it can be a problem. So to go back to the question, and the big question was, which are lighter, and to take care of this debate that one of my friends is having out there. Disc brakes are heavier. That is the bottom line. The disc brakes are heavier. Now that weight is centered down low. It is centered right by the hub on the bike, so it's not as noticeable. But the caliper brake is always going to win when it comes down to the weight and aerodynamics also. So there's a great little piece here that I pulled down, which comes from actually from Performance Bikes, and they have a blog post, and it's rim brakes versus disc brakes. And again, there's lots of discussion out here. There's lots of opinions out here, but stopping power, they start with stopping power, and they say disc brakes, there's no question about this. Disc brakes deliver incredible stopping power in pretty much all weather conditions. What's more, that power can be easily modulated, which means it's easier to control how much brake you need at any given time. Oftentimes, no more than one finger is needed to stop a bike in any reasonable distance. Rim brakes, especially with carbon wheels, can sometimes take a little bit to really bite into the rim and slow the bike down. This is doubly true if your pads are worn or dirty. So that in that case, the disc brake wins out. In compatibility, rim brakes for now. Disc brakes are still going through their growing pains in an industry where the term standard is pretty much meaningless. Well, that's a great statement. That can mean some headaches for consumers. Any of you who work in the bike industry know what I'm talking about. Some disc brake bikes come with the standard quick-release wheel, and some use now a through axle. There are all different kinds of rotor sizes out there, and aftermarket wheel options are still fairly limited. So the through axle is something that comes from the mountain bike industry. The through axle will give you a much stiffer situation. You get more power out of your brake from that. That through axles are really nice, but they really take the quick release out of quick release. So, you know, it depends on what you're looking for. It all depends on what you're looking for. And so they say, as far as the compatibility issues go, they're fairly minor problems. But they do give caliper brakes the advantage on compatibility. Wet weather, disc brakes, by far, no-brainer. No matter what is falling from the sky or laying on the roads, disc brakes don't care. Snow, ice, rain don't have much of an effect on disc brakes, regardless of rim material. Wet weather conditions can severely limit the effectiveness of rim brakes, especially carbon wheels. Okay, ease of installation and maintenance. Now I'm going back to that little story I gave you about Cyclocross Nationals a few years ago. Rim brakes, frankly, they're very easy. Make sure you're facing the right way, bolt them on, make sure they're roughly centered, and go. Every other year or so, you change the pads. Disc brakes, not so much. Mechanical disc brakes can be notoriously frustrating to install and get centered so they aren't rubbing on the disc rotor. Hydraulic disc brakes are easier to install, but the maintenance can be involved and they are time-consuming. Since you have tried to bleed the lines, replace the hydraulic fluid, etc., you know, there's all sorts of things you have to do to get disc brakes, to get them right. And, you know, those who are into it, great. I don't care. That's fine. If you want to love your disc brakes, you can love your disc brakes. But rim brakes are easy. They last longer. They definitely last longer. So that is something to consider. And it depends on what your needs are. Weight and aerodynamics. I believe this is it's one of the last things on their list here. Rim brakes, because of the simple design, rim brakes are currently much, much lighter than any available disc brake system that's out there. And because of where the brake is placed, disc brakes are also much less aerodynamic than rim brakes because they stick out. They're out there in the wind, so they're not as sheltered as a rim brake is. The rim brakes are sheltered in the front by the fork and the fork crown. The rim brakes are sheltered in the back by the stays on the bike, so they're definitely far more aerodynamic. So bear in mind, though, it is likely to change in the next couple of years because they're working on this. Disc brakes become more widely adopted, and the pressure builds and pressure builds to build them in the racing. The industry is likely to begin refining the designs to be lighter and better, incorporating them into frames for improved aerodynamics. But again, I think that jury is out. The verdict that performance has here is that more than any other decision, this is going to be a very personal choice. Disc brakes offer unquestionably better and more consistent stopping power than rim brakes, but at a cost of weight and aerodynamics. And they are still not yet race legal. So you got a problem there. So that means if you love racing, fast road riding, and have plenty of wheel options, you might be best to just stick with those rim brakes for the time being. If you're looking for a road bike to ride for the love of riding, you like to explore gravel roads, bomb down big descents, and ride in an area that experiences frequent bad weather, or even for racers looking for the second bike for training and base miles, then disc brakes are probably a better option. So without question, though, disc brakes are they're the way forward. So love them or hate them, odds are that in the next 5 years, most road bikes will be equipped with them. So anyway, that's the disc brake and caliper brake discussion, which I said I would have. And to talk about the argument of and the debate that was going on out there, as far as my friend Billy goes, you win, Billy. The caliper brakes are certainly lighter. There's no question about that. So I hope that helped you at least get yourself a free drink or a nice pat on the back or whatever from your friend who you're having the discussion with. But it's definitely in my opinion, and I certainly do have a lot of opinions. I like those caliper brakes way better. And I have a funny feeling that Billy does too, because he's kind of an old school guy like me. He likes to ride his bike. He's more interested in what he's riding on than, you know, having the latest and greatest. And I get it. I totally get it. It's a thing. So I'm going to talk a little bit about indoor cycling. I hate to go here because it's like the beginning of the end, but it's there. It's a reality. We live in the cold area. Yeah, we're not in Florida. No, we're not out west. No, we're not in Arizona. We're up in the Northeast. And those of you who listen to me from the Northeast areas or from, let's say, the Michigan central states, the northern states, what we like to call the snow belt states, we have to start making decisions now as to what do we do. We're losing our daylight. We're faced with different types of weather coming through. I know that this weekend here in Connecticut, we're expecting to see highs in the mid-30s on the weekend. I think that's right. It's not good. So, you know, that means it's going to be cold. Or, as I've been telling people, normal. Because it does get cold here in the wintertime, and it does get cold here this time of year. So you have to take a look at maybe some of your other options. Maybe you're running into the shorter day syndrome, because our days are going to get shorter all the way through to the, 21st of December, I believe it is. Is that right? Fran, you know this one better than I do. You have a religion with this. Go.
Sure.
What do you got? Go.
Days are going to continue to get shorter until about December 6th.
Okay.
And then they're going to, they're going to bottom out, and then we're going to actually start gaining light again, at around December 15th, the end of the day.
But it's at the end of the day, not
yes.
the beginning of the day.
No, so beginning of the day, you continue to lose light.
So the morning hours are really dark and dreary.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So the sunset bottoms out at like 20 after 7. I think the sunset was later than that when we were still in daylight savings time. It passed that to like 7:25. But yeah, the sunset bottoms out at 7:19, and it gets there around New Year, like a couple days before the end of the year. So you get to like 7:19, and then it stays there until around January 6th, and then you start gaining minutes at the beginning. So you continue to lose minutes at the beginning of the day, even though the day length is getting longer. The shortest days of the year are, in fact, the day of the solstice, which is about December 21st. And December 22nd is about the same as well. That's both the day length is the same. But yeah, we're losing minutes. We're still losing minutes, and we're going to continue to lose minutes until around December 6th or so, and then it'll flatline. It'll bottom out. And then we'll start gaining them about December 15th.
Yeah. Well, they'll be nice, but, you know, the problem is at that point where we're losing more and more daylight and losing more sun, we're also losing some heat in the process, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Because the sun sits lower and lower and lower, and therefore we don't get as much radiational heat as we would get when the sun is way high in the sky.
Right.
So basically what it comes down to is you kind of have to look at alternatives.
It's going to be colder today than they thought, or they were thinking it was going to get up to 50 today. It's not.
It doesn't feel
like
it.
It's going to stay in like the mid-40s.
Yeah. And that's the other thing. You can never believe what they tell you because it seems like they don't ever quite get it right. But it's what we have. So you may end up indoors. You may end up looking for, an indoor cycling class, someplace where you can go and, sweat with people that are like-minded and, maybe have a little camaraderie there and get you a little bit of inspiration because of that. Or you may just have to, go in your basement or your garage where you can set yourself up with a nice little training place or a plot or whatever you want to call it. And you've got all sorts of things that are at your easy grasp, like, maybe a little table off to the side of your trainer that you can reach out and grab that extra bottle of water or anything you feel like you need that you don't want to have on your body or on your bike while you're riding your bike. And you want to, of course, have that towel with you because you're going to drip. It's going to happen. It's not unusual. A fan is really nice. If you're looking at places that are fitness-oriented, like a gym or a community center or something like that, where they have cycling in their program, I'm particularly a fan of the overhead ceiling fans. Because, boy, they work great. They just, they really move the air nicely in the room. And I know that Fran and I have ridden in big gyms down in Jersey where they have those. There also are fans that sometimes mount on the walls and they oscillate back and forth. Those are really nice. So that's in that situation. But if you're riding in your basement or you're riding in your spare bedroom or wherever it is that you're not afraid to make smell like a gym in your house, You can use, as Jeremy Powers uses, who is a powerhouse in the cyclocross world, he just uses a box fan. And he also tries to make sure that his house is cool enough so that he's not over sweating. He wants it to be a little chilly when he gets on the bike. And he uses a Le Monde Revolution trainer. Is what he used, and it has a big fan built into it, which helps move the air as he rides. So those are kind of cool. Those are the ones with the big fan in the back, and it does push air up and around you as you're riding. So those are kind of cool. There's other people that are using different things, but I know some people use floor fans. There's some really cool floor fans that really push a lot of air up at you. The key point is you want them to push a fair amount of air so you can keep yourself cool. So that's nice. So the other things you want to make sure you have plenty of water nearby. I'm big on having music with me. I really love having that music going on. That's if you're just using a trainer. Now, you can also get into Zwift and all these great programs online. If you have the right trainer for it, you can really make it fun to do to ride indoors and to train indoors. But, yeah, it's a reality. We have to deal with it. For those of you who bundle up and just go out there and do it, a major tip of the winter cycling cap to you, the wool one, that's really cool that you can do that. I am just not of that type. I just can't do it. I don't stay warm. I'm going to mention a couple of upcoming events coming up. We still have two more races in the Connecticut Series of Cross. You can find them on www.ctseriesofcx.com. We have the March Farms Cross on November 24th in Bethlehem, Connecticut, and the Elm City Cross in December on the 17th in New Haven. And those are the last two races of the Connecticut Series. The Connecticut Series, another big tip of the cycling cap there for everything they've done. They're great. They've got a lot of following. We've had some really strong showings at the races, and we're putting Connecticut Cross on the map in a different way. We're kind of starting to become known as the guys that put on the hard cyclocross races. That makes me proud. It's a good thing. So you've been listening to Bicycle Talk with my co-host, Fran Storch, a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. Remember, you can always send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com, and you can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, or you can listen on iTunes. If you would like to contribute or to be on the show as a guest, please contact me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. This is Pedal and Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS, Storrs.